G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letter U.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, my friend.
G'day, Jono. Treasures from the Tanakh, what's that?
What? Treasures from the Tanakh. That's the, remember back, you know, years ago, we used to do a program called Treasures from the Tanakh.
Oh, that's been ages ago.
It's like, it's retro now. It's a blast from
the past. Been a while.
But listen, you've taken some time off. I've taken some time off, but we're back. Has it been since before I went to Israel?
Yep.
There it is. Yep. Okay. So we're back. But here we are, and I'm taking a break. I'm up in Bribie Island, Queensland, boys and girls, which is, as I said to you, It's the Florida of Australia. And it's really nice.
And I know. It's funny. I told you. I saw that picture and... You know, your kids sitting on the couch, or you call lounge, whatever, and it was so funny. Lori and I were laughing because it is furniture that you see in rental homes in Florida on the beach. So it really was true that it's Australia.
I've never been to Florida. I'd love to come sometime. And good day to everybody who listens in Florida, because I know there are thousands of people throughout Florida, Ira, who listen. And hey. By the way, for those who do listen, of course, you're in Florida. We should let everybody know what your webpage is. What is it? It's TorahThreads.com. Is that correct?
Yep, TorahThreads.com. It's getting ready to be upgraded again, and we're going to have some great content on there coming up pretty shortly and some great teaching.
So we'll keep people up to date when that happens. But TorahThreads.com, and you can also find Ira on Facebook at Torah Threads. Go there and like the pages and get involved. So now, where are we up to? This is Job chapter 29.
Job 29.
Hey, there's some gold in here. I'm going to start reading.
Let me just do a little bit of, context for everybody.
Go on.
You know, to show where we were before you start reading.
Sure.
So, you know, if we remember in way back before you went to Israel, we did Job 27 and 28. And we talked about this being meshalim, you know, that they're like proverbs. Mm. And this is a continuation now of these two meshalim. We had 27 and 28, which were all about wisdom. Mm-hmm. And we kind of made the point that Job presents his argument for why he had become belligerent against his friends that had brought all these charges against him. And he kind of made the point that... He was willing to accept the fact that he didn't understand God's ways, but he was not going to trade the wisdom of God for what he considered the nonsensical arguments of his friends and the fact that they were attributing unrighteousness to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he maintains that he can only demonstrate his loyalty by his relentless challenging of God. And this is what we see. We have to remember from the very beginning of the show, even way back at the beginning, we talked about the divine council, the divine court. Mm-hmm. And this being a whole courtroom drama where all of these players are coming in and prosecuting and defending. And of course, God and the divine court are watching this whole time. You know, of course, we're not going to see God respond until we get past these meshalim. And then, of course, we see the mysterious guy Elihu come, you know, and we see several chapters of him coming and speaking and Job not responding. And then as soon as we're done with that, then we see God speaking out of the whirlwind for the first time.
Yes.
You know, having sat by and listened to the whole courtroom drama for 41 chapters, I think it is.
Mm.
And so moving forward, we kind of have Job entering into his own little world again, and he reflects on his bittersweet past that's no longer available to him and the suffering of his present condition. And look, you have to wonder, and we've said this often, you have to wonder what it is that keeps this guy going. I mean, he has a present that seems almost too horrible for any one of us to contemplate. Mm. I mean, I'm not gonna make you sick to your stomach until later, Jono. So I won't bring up any of that stuff until later.
Later.
But
okay.
Well, actually, we may not do it tonight because we're in 29, and I think I have some good stuff in 30 to get you going. But
all right.
but look, I mean, he's got a horrible present and the future doesn't seem to offer much more hope.
No.
And yet this guy keeps going. He's like the, you know, It used to be the old Timex commercial, takes a licking and keeps on ticking, or, you know, the Energizer Bunny that just keeps going.
And this is Job. And so, And so in this chapter, we do, as you mentioned, we learn a little bit more about his standing in the community, his past, and the way that he was perceived and the things that he achieved. So this is interesting. So it begins like this. It says, Job further continued his discourse and said, Oh, that I were as in months past. And we don't know how many months that is, do we?
Right.
I mean, it could be, but I don't know. I mean, could he have said, you know, if it were a couple of years, I think he would have said, oh, you know, maybe years past. But we could be talking, you know, well over half a year has passed. But we really don't know. But in any case, it is a number of months, as in the days when God watched over me. Now, is he suggesting that God no longer sees him, or is he saying that the days when God protected me, I was under his protection?
No. There's no question at this point that he's questioning. And of course, we may see a little bit of that in 29, but we'll definitely see when we get into chapter 30 that he absolutely feels that way.
Mm-hmm. When his lamp shone upon my head, and when by his light I walked through the darkness. And that takes me to the psalm, that thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. And and he feels totally abandoned in this way, just as I was in the days of my prime. And when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were around me, and my steps were bathed with cream?
Yep, with cream or with butter.
Slippery, really.
and the rock poured me out rivers of oil.
Mm.
You know, that verse in 5, you know, when the Almighty was yet with me and my children were about me, this kind of brings you back to the beginning of the study in Job 1, verse 9 and 10,
mm-hmm.
When it says, it is for nothing that Eov fears God. Have you not protected him, his household, and all that he has? You have blessed whatever he has undertaken, and his possessions are spread throughout the land. You know, the Satan, the adversary,
mm-hmm.
you know, is challenging God in that. You know, that's one of the things that he says. He talks about the fact, we see Job commenting on the fact that in the days of old, in those months of old, that he did have the, you know, the converse of God or the counsel of God over his tent, and that God shone a light upon him. But now it's obvious that, you know, that this is not true anymore. And as I said, it takes us back to the beginning and the challenge that the Satan brought.
So now, would you call it just this is a side note, but would you call it a challenge, or would you call it just questioning as to whether it is the case that, you know, because the Satan.
Look, I mean, Satan is, his job is the challenge. And in a sense, you know, I mean, not challenging God in the sense of authority. But this is, you know, as an agent, as a malach or a messenger of God, you know, that's what he does. That's
Fair enough. So he's reflecting
his
character.
Job. God gave him that job. So it's, you know, it's not what people think. Again, we talked extensively in this in Job chapter 1 and 2 and 3, you know, about the role of Satan, the role of the messenger. I mean, look, we talk about this in, what is it, in Kings, where we talk about, you know, the lying spirit that's sent forth by God.
Mm-hmm.
It's not unusual for God to task one of his messengers, one of the malachim, with a role that seems out of character to us.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly within the nature of God.
Because of the character that he has been created with by Yehovah, then that's a very good point that you make, that it would make sense that he is challenging God as to the reason why Job is the way he is, as God describes him as blameless and upright and so on and so forth, his servant Job. So it goes on to say, when I went to the gates by the city, when I took my seat in the open square, the young men saw me and hid, and the aged arose and stood, and the princes refrained from talking and put their hands on their mouths, and the voice of the nobles was hushed, and their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth. That reminds me of, what's that? That's Psalm 137, I think, isn't it? Where David says, if I forget Jerusalem, may I forget the skill of my right hand.
Right.
And if I forget Jerusalem, may my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth. Again, another phrase that is not unusual, not foreign, I suppose.
Yep, one of the very famous verses and psalms, and very powerful. Actually, it's something that we sing at weddings in
sure.
Judaism.
Really?
Im ishkechech Yerushalayim tishkach yemini. It's a very famous, there's a very famous tune to it, you know, in mourning the temple and mourning, you know, Jerusalem, you know, and the idea that, that God would speedily in our days rebuild Jerusalem as the holy city.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. But this these verses 7 to 10, clearly Job was highly esteemed.
He was an elder. We know that the city gates is where the elder sat. You know, this is a typical thing that we see, you know, throughout the Torah and the Tanakh, and it was typical in that day, you know, in biblical times, that this is where the elder sat in the gates of the city. And so, you know, not only was he recognized as an elder, but an elder of an elder. I mean, look, princes shut their mouths, nobles, leaders, you know, quarter officers were hushed. You know, the aged elders would stand up, you know, in his presence. So this, you know, this harkens back also to the fact that I don't know if you remember early on in our discussion of who Job was. I posited the idea that he could have potentially been one of the Eastern kings.
Mm-hmm.
And in light of this, that would kind of make sense, because why would nobles and leaders and nasi, you know, princes and court officers and aged elders and so forth
stand
in his presence?
Yeah, so. Absolutely. No, I really do. I agree with that. And it goes on to say, when the ear heard, then it blessed me. And when the eye saw, then it approved me, because I delivered the poor. And these are the things that he achieved. I delivered the poor who cried out, the fatherless and the one who had no help. The blessing of a perishing man came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on, before I get to 14.
Well, you know, wait a minute. You know, I have to stop you there for a second, because, you know, you know, first of all, you know, it's funny, because the first thing that struck me is when we think about when the ear heard me, you know, would commend me or applaud me, and when the eye saw me, it gave witness unto me. The first thing I thought about, I don't know if in Australia they ever had these commercials, but we have this, you know, this financial house, you know, a brokerage house years ago called E.F. Hutton. And they used to have a commercial that when E.F. Hutton speaks, everybody listens. So there would be two people like in a restaurant in this conversation, and they would start speaking, and one would go E.F. Hutton, and everybody would stop and lean over to listen, you know. But then I'm looking at these next couple of verses, and I have to tell you, you know, come on, Job is even... I think he goes a little bit overboard, even more so than what God says about him. You know,
do you think so?
I think there's a little much here, you know, coming from him. You know, think about it. A blessing of him that was ready to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. You know, I clothed myself with righteousness. You know, this whole thing, you know, what does he say before that? I delivered the poor that cried, the fatherless also that had none to help him. You know, I'm not saying, remember, I always bring perspectives. I'm not hanging my hat on these things, you know, but I always question when I read these kind of things. And one of the things that I question in these Meshalim that we're reading is, did Job really love the way he thought he loved? Was he really doing things with the right motivation? And this could be one of the issues for him. This could be one of the issues that we have with Job was his motivation out of pure love for God and love for the people, or was it a matter of position and pride and so forth? Just a perspective, not saying that's, you know.
But the possibility, you're floating the possibility that perhaps Job was a little more proud.
I mean, look, God didn't go into this flowery speech about how wonderful Job was. He said, have you considered Job? You know, he was righteous, he was blameless, so forth. That's fine. I don't have an issue with that God said that. But, you know, our righteousness is usually coupled with humility.
Yes. Okay. So,
and there's not a lot of humility being displayed by Job, you know, when he goes into these flowery speeches about everything he did.
Okay.
I did this for the poor.
Potentially a little bit of pride, potentially a lack of humility here in his achievements. Okay, so that's a different way of looking at it, and it didn't occur to me. But we'll leave that to the listener to make up their mind.
Well, let's look at the next couple of verses and see what you think about that.
Well, I want to talk about verse 14 for a minute, and I'll probably leave the farm on this one. But it says, "I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban." And I thought, you know what? That reminds me of something. I remember something like that in my Sunday church days. And I thought, surely there's a cross-reference. And I looked down. I mean, because look, this is an opportunity here, Ira. And I looked down to see the cross-reference, and it's not there. But do you know the cross?
I know you have to have it. What do you mean? Well, you always have one of those. You always have one of those Bibles that has a cross-reference and then has a heading. And
yeah, this is the Bible, the New King James Nelson Study Bible. And I thought, for sure, there's an opportunity. You've got to put in the cross-reference there because it takes them back to the New Testament. But it didn't do it. But instead, it had a cross-reference to Isaiah 59, verses 17. Verse 17, this is what it says. It says, "For he put on righteousness as a breastplate and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on the garments of vengeance for clothing and was clad with..." Clad, there's a word. "He was clad with zeal as a cloak." And I thought, oh, for sure, this has got to have a cross-reference. And I looked down, and lo and behold, on this one, it does, Ira. It has Ephesians verses 14 and 17. And, of course, we're talking about in the New Testament, this is the, what do they call this? This is the armor of God, right?
What was that? Ephesians what? Ephesians what?
Ephesians 6. Okay. The latter half of the chapter. It talks about the armor of God. And particularly it says, "Standing therefore, having girded your waist with..." And this is Paul, right? "Having put on the breastplate of righteousness," there it is, "having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace, above all, taking the shield of faith with which you are able to quench the fiery darts of the wicked one, and take your helmet..."
You know what I like about that? What I like about those verses that What's you just that? Read? There's one thing that always sticks out to me when somebody reads those verses. Mm-hmm. The preparation of the gospel of peace. You know why it sticks out to me? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I always find it comical that, you know, that people go to a church and they have this experience, call it being saved or being born again. And then, they're a Christian for, I don't know, a week or two. And then the next thing you know, they're out there on the street, you know, witnessing. So how is that preparation? I remember when I lived on South Beach in Florida. South Beach is now one of the most decadent places in the world. But I lived there before the full regentrification. And there was this one guy, man, you couldn't go out to dinner. You know, there were a lot of outdoor cafes and things like that. You just couldn't go out to dinner because you'd be sitting having a nice dinner with your wife or your girlfriend or whatever, and this guy would come running up. "Heaven or hell, your choice." I mean, as you're sitting at a restaurant, yeah, this guy would jump into your face. "Heaven or hell, your choice." I'm like, dude, really? You know? And then when I interacted with those verses, I thought to myself, you know, there's something to be said about spending a little bit more time on the preparation of the gospel of peace. For the people that you send out on the street.
Well, then that's true. And obviously, if one
turn
is,
or burn,
if one is to be prepared. Well, then how about you read from the beginning of the book onwards? But there's a good start. But it goes on to say, "And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God." There you go. And so, why not start with the Word of God? Let's go back to the Tanakh and read that and get a grasp on that before we do anything else. But you see, the thing is, Ira, that it's not really about you said it says the preparation of the gospel of peace, but we only have to go back to verse 11, it says, "Put on the whole armor of God." This is Ephesians 6:11. "Put on the whole armor of God," that I just read out, "that you may," and this is why, "that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the..."
Uh-oh.
Devil.
Who's that?
He's a new character that appears in the New Testament. We don't have the devil in the Tanakh. Am I right?
Well, we don't. I mean, there are people that think we do.
There are people who think we do, but
you like talked the about church that. Lady on Saturday Night Live.
But that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil, because, you know, it says we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and against rulers and, you know, the dark ages and, you know, the spiritual hosts and the wickedness of the heavenly places, and therefore take up the whole armor of God. But the interesting thing is that if you go back to Isaiah 59, and this is obviously where he gets a lot of his material, Isaiah 59, verse 17. It's Yehovah who's putting on the righteousness as a breastplate and a helmet of salvation for his head, and he put on the garments of vengeance for clothing and was clad with zeal as a cloak. According to their deeds, accordingly he will repay fury to his adversaries, recompense to his enemies. The coastlands he will fully repay, and it's talking about men, right?
Yeah, of course. And I mean, you know, we know pretty clearly that, you know, in Isaiah very clearly speaks about in other verses. I mean, for instance, Isaiah 43, 10 and 11, you know, we find very clearly that God says that there is nobody before him, no God after him. He is the only savior.
And so it's an interesting thing that you just quoted Isaiah saying that there is no other God formed after him. There's no God before him. He is the only God. And that's one of the big difficulties that Judaism has with Christianity, of course. That is that Paul identifies the devil, this devil figure that appears only in the New Testament, this concept of the devil, which many suggest is borrowed from Zoroastrianism, but that's another story, and we have talked about that before. But he describes the devil as a god, the god of this world.
Sure. That's why I was, you know, I laugh about this all the time because, you know, this picture keeps coming up in my mind when you brought up about the devil, you know, and this idea that, you know, this character doesn't exist, you know, but there are people within Christianity, whatever form of Christianity, you know, assume that because we see the character that we talked about before, HaSatan, the adversary, he's been given this capital S name, Satan, mm-hmm. You know, and I always hearken back to this character that we had on a, you know, very popular American comedy show on Saturday night called Saturday Night Live. And one of the, you know, one of the actors, Dana Carvey, did this skit every week called The Church Lady. And her name was Enid Strict. And, you know, it was a spoof on, you know, the holier than thou Christian churchgoers. And what they would always do, they would have, you know, like one of the celebrities that was on the show, they'd always have a celebrity on every week and she would be interviewing them. And, you know, typically what she would do is she would, you know, she would question them about their lack of piety and, you know, their secular lifestyles. And, you know, she'd come with these judgmental, you know, admonishments and damnation. And then, you know, when she would ask, well, I wonder why, you know, I wonder who that is that caused you to do that. And then she'd go, could it be Satan?
But there's so much truth to that, Ira, isn't there? I mean, there really, really is. There are people, at least in my experience, and I know we're getting off the topic. We're going to return to Job in just a second.
I know.
But in my experience.
Well, but Job speaks about this. So, you know, I mean, I want it to be made clear because this is, you know, not to interrupt you, but it's got to be, we're joking about it, but the point is that Job is one of the main books that people go back to support the false notion that there is a devil. And that's why it's important that we need to
revisit this every few chapters. It needs to be revisited because there is this understanding from the Christian church, Sunday Christian church. And incidentally, in my experience in the Sunday Christian church, Ira, I've met people who need that God that is the devil, the God of this world that they say. They need that character. They have to have him. They love him. It's the guy that you love to hate, and without him, your life is just not as exciting anymore because of this imaginary battle that goes, this spiritual battle that goes on, and they really do build it up in their own heads. And they look at this this section in Ephesians chapter 6 about the armor of God, and they really take it very seriously. And one of the interesting things about that passage is that when you read it in the Greek, there's a word that is repeated over and over again, and it equates to the English word withstand, which I think is a good thing to do. I don't have the Greek in front of me, but James 4, verse 7, and I just wish that these people who find the devil character so necessary to their faith, that elaborates so much upon their spiritual walk with this character, I wish they would just take James 4, verse 7 a little more seriously, because what it says, therefore submit to God, resist, and that word is withstand in the Greek, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. That sounds pretty simple.
Right, but do you know why people...
They don't want him to flee from them. They need the challenge. They need the...
Why? I'll give you the answer why.
There's no fireworks otherwise. I'll tell you why. Let me tell you.
They need somebody to blame because they don't have the ability to subdue their evil inclination. That's the bottom line.
Well, there's that. There is that. But I think it's more than that. I think without this character and without elaborating on this character and making him the god of this world and the god in the pantheon of Sunday Christianity, then you're really playing a game of playing team sport with one team.
There's an accountability that's required that doesn't allow you to blame, your failings on anybody else but yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have something to hold on like this, it's like, again, I hate to keep using these, these modern American examples, but, it's like we used to have this comedian that also had a show called Flip Wilson, and he used to dress up as a woman named Geraldine, and the tagline was always, "The devil made me do it."
Mm-hmm.
That was always the tagline. Whenever she did anything that she wasn't supposed to do, it was the devil made me do it. And this is typical. I mean, I had a friend years ago that was a born-again Christian. And when I lived on South Beach, and I remember one time he was late coming to a meeting, and I said, "What happened?" And he said, "Oh, the devil attacked me." And I go, "Well, what do you mean?" And he goes, "Oh, I was parked at a bus stop, and I got a ticket."
Yeah, I remember you telling me.
Yeah, and I'm like, "What? What the heck? What do you mean? It's illegal to park at a bus stop. How is that the devil attacking you?" But this is the mindset.
Mm. It's always a good backup plan. I mean, the devil is a good backup plan. If it doesn't go right, if something goes wrong, if potentially it was your fault, we can't have that because I'm too spiritual. So it was the devil trying to get to me. Now, we've spoken about this before. In fact, you know what? When I was preaching in the Sunday church, that was always my backup plan. If ever I was standing up behind the pulpit, I always thought, because I was in a Pentecostal church, right? If I say something ridiculous, mm-hmm. I can always drop to the floor and manifest a bit, and everyone will blame it on the devil.
Right. So if you were preaching and the lights went off or the sound system went off, because a fuse blew. It wasn't that the fuse blew or there was a problem with the electric. It was that you had something so special to say that the devil had to stop you. Right?
That's what it is. Now, I know a lot of people are listening to this again.
We should stop. We should
because really, we've, yeah. t- no, we've touched on this before. We've touched on it a number of times. And as you well pointed out, it needs to be reiterated as we go through, Job. But if you go back to the earlier programs of Treasures from the Snark, the earlier chapters of Job, we do address this in a little bit more detail. Also, there is a program that Yoel Ben Shlomo and I did called Hell, Hades, and Hasatan. So yeah. If you put in that in the search engine on truthtoyou.org, Hell, Hades, and Hasatan, it's covered there as well. Let me just say this.
You know, for anybody that's listening, I don't want you to think that I'm mocking your faith. I'm not doing that. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to challenge people.
Amen.
With perspectives. I'm trying to challenge you with the truth. I'm trying to show you from a Jewish perspective, from a Hebraic perspective, from the Tanakh, what the Tanakh really says. If you want to believe that, that's fine. But don't try to attribute it to the Hebrew scriptures because it's not supported by that. If you're comfortable with the New Testament and you're comfortable with this concept of a devil, that's all you. All I'm asking you not to do is to try and take this concept of Hasatan, which is very clearly laid out mm-hmm. by God, very clearly laid out as to who he is, what his role is, how God uses him, and then try to connect it to that concept of the devil in the New Testament. It is not comparable.
It's not comparable. It's two totally different things. They have two totally different origins. And so you need to do your homework if we've just confused you. But if you must... And look, everybody has met the people that really overdo it with the whole demons and the devil and all this sort of stuff. And we all have to, you know who I'm talking about, listeners. I'm sure you've met mm-hmm. one, and maybe you are one of those people. But if you must have the God of this world in your life, because it just makes it all a bit more exciting, please let me refer you to James chapter 4, verse 7. Because if you do withstand the devil, according to the New Testament, this devil character will flee from you and it's all over and stop it. And then people say, but what is left if we don't have this great spiritual battle to battle against? What is left for our spiritual lives, our walk, our biblical, what is left? Well, what's left
is... It's very clear in the Hebrew scriptures, we have a Yetzer Tov and a Yetzer Hara. We have a good inclination and evil inclination. Mm-hmm. And this is what we battle our entire life, to overcome evil inclination.
And the and it's summed up quite nicely in Ecclesiastes 12:13, which says, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil." So that's what it is. Amen. So get on with our lives. Let's live our lives, and let's observe the Torah as we do it. That's all he asks. Let's be obedient children.
Let's get on with Job now.
Let's get on with Job. And so we come back to Job.
Yeah, look at 15. So we're back to this again. So look what he says.
Now he does. He says, I was eyes to the blind. I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the poor. I searched out the case that did not that I did not know. I broke the fangs of the wicked. Does that mean there were vampires back then?
The jaws of the unjust.
The jaws of the unjust. And I plucked. Is that what you've got?
Yes.
There you go. That makes, wow, I've got fangs of the wicked. But they really want a bit of,
well,
anyway.
Of course, because, well, I mean, I'm reading from the Hebrew. You're reading what? New King James?
New King James. And plucked the victim from his teeth.
Right.
Okay.
Plucked the prey. Plucked the prey out of his teeth.
So you reckon it's just a little bit of self-righteousness, a little bit of...
Well, I mean, you tell me.
Well, but I mean, what if these things are true? What if he did all these things? What if this was his, I mean, hey, I mean, it's also a possibility that he is the guy. He's the man.
Don't we have some evidence in the Tanakh from God that, you know, he requires us to be just a little bit humble and recognize that everything that we have comes from him?
True.
I mean, didn't he make it clear to Israel that, you know, he wanted them to understand that when they went into the land, that it wasn't by their own hand.
True. But doesn't he begin that way when he says, you know, the days when God watched over me, his lamp shone upon my head and his light as I walked in the darkness. And just in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, then the Almighty was yet with me. Does right. that not set the potentially?
It could. It could. But it just seems a little bit out of character for me that somebody would go into all of these things about what he did, what I did. I did. I was the deliverer. I was the one that broke the jaws of the unjust. I did all these things.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that answers may come to that question as we continue through the book of Job. But it goes on to say in 18, "Then I said, I shall die in my nest and multiply my days as the sand. My root is spread out to the waters, and the dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is fresh within me, and my bow is renewed
in my hand.
Men listened to me and waited and kept silent for my counsel. And after my words, they did not speak again."
I want you to know that where it says, and they waited, it actually comes from the root to cause the hope. Like, in other words, to me they gave ear, and I gave them hope.
Mm.
I gave them cause to hope.
Fair enough. "And after my words, they did not speak again." Now, incidentally, his three friends haven't spoken for a while.
Sure.
And he seems to have either they're thrown in the towel, or they just have nothing to say. "And my speech settled on them as dew, and they waited for me as one as for the rain, and they opened their mouth wide as for the spring rain." So they were...
Ooh, that's, what do you mean, the spring rain?
That's what I've got.
No.
What do you got?
The latter rain.
Ah.
You're talking to me. Aren't you a Pentecostal?
There's another opportunity missed. What's that about?
They opened their mouth as wide for the latter rain. Come on, don't you know about the latter rain?
Oh, good heavens. I mean, the that's another opportunity missed. They should have had that there.
Yeah, you know, well, you know why it, so why you have late rains is because, you know, there are two times of rain in the land.
Mm-hmm.
Deuteronomy 11:14, it uses similar wording, you know, as it relates to latter rain. And it says in Deuteronomy 11:14, that I will give the rain of your land and its season, the former rain and the latter rain, or the early rain and the late rain,
mm-hmm.
that thou may gather in thy corn and thy wine and thy oil. and really, those words are still used today, even though they're old biblical terms. And the one word is malkosh. Malkosh is, and interestingly enough, malkosh is one of the few Hebrew words that we actually have a partial pre-biblical provenance for.
Really?
Because in it occurs in the 10th century BCE. There was an agricultural calendar inscribed on a clay tablet and found about 100 years ago at the site of Tel Gezer in central Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the Gezer calendar, the first half of the year consists of 2 months of gathering the harvest. It's called Asif. And then 2 months of early sowing, zera, which is seed, and then 2 months of late sowing, lekesh. Mm-hmm. And the first round of sowing grain in the ancient Middle East took place in November and December when the early rains had softened the ground. I don't know, did you get a lot of rain? You were there in December, right?
In Israel, no, I was there in March.
Oh, in March.
Yeah, we did get a little bit of rain, but it wasn't...
Okay, but December, like when I've often gone in December, December is hit or miss. December is really when the rainy season begins, mm-hmm. okay, and that's the early rains that soften the ground enough mm-hmm. to plow it easily. And the second round that I talked about, lekesh, then is followed in January and February. But for the lekesh to succeed, there had to be rain in less dependable months of March and April, and that was malkosh. So this idea of the latter rain is rain that you have the early rains that were in December, and then you have these late rains that were in March and April, and that's what's called malkosh. So I just thought that was interesting because it is one of those few Hebrew words that's even used today, but also has a pre-biblical provenance because they found that that archaeological calendar that speaks about the early rain and the late rain.
That's interesting.
But I just think it's funny because this verse in Job is one of those things that, again, is used in the same way that a concept like Satan, you know, is perverted, mm-hmm. you know, into the Satan. We have this idea of the latter rain that's part of this whole Pentecostal movement, mm-hmm. you know, and the idea of the latter rain of these miracles flowing down and so forth. And
well familiar with that.
Job and Deuteronomy are both used for that.
I went to that cross-reference, Zechariah chapter 10, verse 1, and it says, ask Yehovah for rain. In the time of the latter rain, Yehovah will make flashing clouds, and he will give them showers of rain, grass in the field for everyone.
Right, and there would be another example of a verse that would be used about that, mm-hmm. about this idea of the latter rain, the mm-hmm. early rain and the latter rain.
No doubt a lot of listeners are familiar with that tradition and the way that those concepts have been used. 24, if I mocked at them, they did not believe it. If I mocked at them, they did not believe it, and the light of my countenance they did not cast down. What's that about?
Actually, it could be mocked or if I laughed on them.
So I'm trying. It's a curious verse because I'm trying to put those two sentences together. If I mocked at them, if I mocked at them, they did not believe it, and the light of my countenance they did not cast down. That I can understand. The light of his countenance they did not cast down. How does that parallel to if I mocked at them, they did not believe it? I don't know. That's a curious verse.
Yeah, and I'm looking. I think it's interesting how the JPS translates it.
Oh, here we go. No, the JPS. I'm reading that now. Yeah,
they translate it. When I smiled at them, they would not believe it. They never expected a sign of my favor.
Well, there's a verse that makes sense, though. If that's what it says in the Hebrew, then I can understand what's being projected there. When I smiled at them, they would not believe it. They never expected a sign of my favor.
Right.
Okay. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, it kind of makes. Yeah. I mean, it kind of makes a little bit of sense. You know, is a softening of the translation, what we say, in order to make it more understandable to the
English.
You know, to in the English.
Okay. Well, I'm going to run with that for the time being, but we'll let the listeners...
It's just because it's just one of those ones. I mean, look, it's Job. I mean, there are just some verses that are going to be
really
very difficult poetic language to really make sense of what's being said.
And this is potentially one of those.
Especially when it doesn't flow.
So have a look in your own translations, people, because that's 29 verse 24, just a little bit of a difficult, possibly a clumsy one to interpret into English. But I do personally, at least having not looked at the Hebrew, at least I can grasp what verse 24 means in the JPS. The last verse says, I chose the way for them and they sat as chief. Oh, sorry. I chose the way for them and sat as chief.
And?
So I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts mourners.
Mm-hmm.
King.
King.
So he certainly was, it certainly does appear that he was the king of his province.
Right. And sounds like a very benevolent king. But this is why I brought up the possibility, just a slight possibility, that he was a little bit too full of himself. You know, even though he knew God was with him, was he a loving, benevolent king, or was he just, you know, was it out of the right motivation? That's all I'm saying. I'm just throwing out another perspective.
But
this is how I study. So I'm not saying that I believe that that's an absolute. I'm just saying that when I study this, new things come up for me. And so this time when I'm looking at it, I'm looking at it from a new perspective. I never thought about it until I looked at it today and read those verses.
So I'm
this
just
is
looking,
a new concept for me.
I'm looking at my my new JPS, and it's got some study notes on, and it says, high social status is afforded the person who succeeds in consoling mourners in their bereavement. Given the failure of Job's friends to console with him properly, Job's words are all the more poignant. Okay, interesting. But listen, as a king, if he is a king, if he is indeed regarded as a king of his province, then perhaps we would expect him to speak like this.
Yeah.
Maybe.
No, there's no question. There's no question that that's possible.
Okay.
But then all I'm saying is that, you know, that's expected of a king, but, you know, remember, kings in the day, you know, certainly not the kings of Israel, but he wasn't a king of Israel. You know, and had he come from a pagan background and then come to the knowledge of the one true God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, did he wrestle with this idea of divine nature and so forth? You know, because we see a lot of times that the monarchy, you know, has this, you know, connotation attached to it of some type of divinity.
Fair enough. Okay, so that is there's another view that's worth taking into consideration. But we've reached the end of the chapter. Chapter 30 next time, and it actually goes on. This is interesting. The speech that Job gives does go on for another two chapters, but we're only doing a chapter at a time. There's chapter 29. Ira Michelson, Treasures from the Tanakh. Thank you, my friend, for coming back on.
Thank you.
And just,
thank you for having.
Just a reminder to the listeners, TorahThreads.com is the website, Ira's website, TorahThreads.com, and you'll find that also on Facebook. You're listening to Truth to You, Treasures from the Tanakh. Join us next time when we launch into chapter 30. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.